Lecture 18, Atomic Spies and Spy Hunts.
Among the great adventures of the 20th century, and among its human tragedies, are the stories of people escaping across the Iron Curtain to the West. Hundreds died in the attempt, however, for the crime of wanting to get out. But who would ever think of breaking in through the Iron Curtain, from the West to the East, into the Soviet Union? On an October night in 1950, an American Dakota transport plane flew eastwards. The plane had taken off from an American Air Force base in the western zone of occupied Germany. The resistance leader, known by his code name Daumantas, was going home. He had been born in 1921 in Lithuania, the southernmost of the Baltic states. He had been an architecture student, but then had joined in the resistance against foreign occupiers of his country, the Soviets, then the Nazis, and then the Soviets again. In 1946, he had headed for the Lithuanian forests, joining the armed guerrilla resistance of the so-called Forest Brothers. In 1949, he had been given messages from the Forest Brothers to take to the West, in search of support for the cause of Lithuania's independence. Now, after training in covert operations in the West, Daumantas was returning, but it was unclear to him how much support for his cause the Western countries would really give. There, in the West, the Second World War had ended. Here, in the Baltic forests, it continued, as the guerrillas fought against the Soviet security forces. After a flight of 4 hours, the plane crossed the Soviet border briefly by the Baltic Sea coast, flying very low in order to avoid Soviet radar. Soon afterwards, Daumantas and several of his comrades parachuted out. The next year, however, in 1951, Daumantas was killed, betrayed by a double agent in the ranks of the resistance fighters. Even while the Second World War was going on, the often uneasy alliance between the United States and Britain on the one hand, and Stalin's Soviet Union on the other, had experienced friction and tension. These were actually omens of the coming Cold War, which would see the former allies in the struggle against Nazi Germany facing off against one another across a world stage. We can shed light on these tensions by looking closely at a detail that we had finished with in the last lecture, the portents of a new age in technological warfare, the Nazi development of secret weapons, and the atomic bomb developed by the Americans and the British. In each case, covert operations and espionage activity showed that the former allies were starting to draw apart. In the last stages of the Second World War, Hitler had placed his last desperate hopes on terrible new weapons. Fortunately, Nazi scientists had not made as much progress as their foes had feared in terms of atomic weapons. But the Nazis were able to roll out frightening new kinds of aerial weapons. The program was directed by the young rocket expert Werner von Braun. The first of these weapons was the V-1. In German, this stood for Vergeltungswaffe, meaning revenge weapon. And it was a flying bomb that flew at speeds of over 400 miles per hour to reach its destination. The next innovation, the V-2, was different in kind. It was a ballistic missile, a precursor of the moon rocket. Traveling at 4 times the speed of sound, the V-2 was so fast that it allowed no warning before impact. These missiles, launched against Britain in the last stages of the war, caused tremendous damage and fear. It seemed clear to many that these were the weapons of the future, a decisive new generation of weaponry. The British were able to use their double cross operation to actually misdirect the firing of the missiles. They would have fake Nazi agents who allegedly were stationed in England report back to Nazi Germany on the location of the impact of the rockets. And in this way, by misdirecting them, they could steer the targeting to areas outside of metropolitan London, areas where the explosions would do less damage. But the British cabinet agonized over this role for their deception operation. They asked themselves whether it was right to play God, as it were, and direct missiles away from one set of people toward another set of people. Nonetheless, they decided to go ahead. As the Americans and Soviets were impressed with the potential of these new weapons, even as their armies advanced into Germany just before it was defeated, special teams were sent out by the Americans and Soviets to search for the German scientists who had constructed these weapons. It was a race for destructive knowledge. The American operation was called Operation Paperclip. Operation Paperclip managed to secure Wernher von Braun, who then went on to work for the U.S. Army on rocket construction and then with NASA. A parallel phenomenon of hiring former enemies, of enlisting them for one's own cause in the Cold War, in the world of intelligence, involved Nazi Germany's chief of military intelligence on the Eastern Front, fighting against the Soviets, Reinhard Gehlen. Gehlen and some of his colleagues surrendered to the Americans and struck a deal. They informed the Americans that they had secreted their data on the Soviets, which might prove useful to the Americans in the future. Gehlen was allowed to set up a new organization outside of Munich in Bavaria in southern Germany. And it included many staff members who had been active in the Nazi regime. They worked under U.S. Army control and then under that of the new CIA until in 1956 Gehlen's organization became the independent Bundesnachrichtendienst, the Federal Intelligence Service of West Germany, and played an active role in the Cold War. Even more important in terms of portents of a new age of warfare was the development of the atomic bomb in a secret program called the Manhattan Project. A crucial part of this story took place in the foothills of the Smoky Mountains in East Tennessee as an entire secret city was built up in Oak Ridge. Here, in this installation, uranium and plutonium were separated and produced for use in the atom bomb. This secret city was enclosed and self-sufficient. It was behind barbed wire, with up to 70,000 men and women working 10-hour shifts to produce a weapon that might win the war. Not possessing it might mean losing the war. On July 16, 1945, a key moment in human history took place. The first atomic bomb was detonated at 5:29 a.m. in New Mexico, sending a mushroom cloud miles into the air, for all time a symbol of the new atomic age. In August 1945, the U.S. dropped two bombs on Japan at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, leading to Japan's surrender. Mankind had entered a new historical period. There was no going back. One cannot uninvent or unknow such powerful knowledge, much as one might want to. This is a tragic aspect or dimension to human progress in this case, that destructive knowledge can't be turned back. This secret scientific program also attracted Soviet attention, and because the stakes were so high, Soviet espionage. Stalin's intelligence services were tipped off about planning for the atomic bomb by late 1941. They were tipped off by one of the Cambridge spies, Cairncross, who was secretary to a top British official. The Soviet code name for the Manhattan Project was Operation Enormous, or Enormous. Now, remember that in tradecraft, one is usually not supposed to use a name for an operation that gives a hint as to the content of the operation. In this case, however, it sure sounded like a recognition of the potentially vast importance of the project. Lavrenty Beria, head of the Soviet secret police, the NKVD, gave the highest priority to penetrating the atomic project. The Soviets gained spies who were in the project and who spied for ideological conviction. They included Klaus Fuchs and David Greenglass at Los Alamos Laboratory and a crucial high-level official, Donald McLean, whom we had already met when discussing the Cambridge spy ring, of which he was a member, in Lecture 15. McLean, from 1944, was the first secretary in the British Embassy in Washington and became, in summer 1945, the main coordinator of American-British cooperation on the atomic bomb effort. Who were these people? Klaus Fuchs was the most important. He was a British scientist who'd been born in Germany and had become a committed communist before fleeing Germany when Hitler came to power. In Britain, he had been recruited for the Tube Alloy Project, the codename given to the British Atomic Development Program. And he passed secrets about it to the GRU, the Soviet Military Intelligence Agency. Fuchs was sent to the United States to work on the shared undertaking and there passed secrets to a Soviet courier, Harry Gold. Gold was also in touch with David Greenglass, an American soldier who was a technical assistant at Los Alamos Lab. Greenglass, in turn, was brother-in-law to Julius Rosenberg. Rosenberg was an electrical engineer in New York, the son of Russian Jewish immigrants involved in communist politics. And Rosenberg had married Ethel Greenglass. The information that this ring passed to the Soviets aided in speeding the Soviet atomic weapon program forward. And this was especially significant in view of a crucial fact. As the war was coming to a close, the alliance of the Soviet Union and the Western Allies was starting to disintegrate. In February 1945, the leaders of the Big Three Powers, as they were called, that was Stalin, FDR, and Churchill, met in Yalta, in Crimea, in the south of the Soviet Union, on the Black Sea. There, the Allied leaders planned the post-war world. FDR hoped to cajole and conciliate Stalin into cooperation, especially on the topic of the United Nations. FDR had brought along with him a State Department official, Alger Hiss, to help in those negotiations. And recall that Alger Hiss, before the war, had been accused of being a Soviet spy by a former Soviet courier, Whitaker Chambers, but nothing had happened then. All these negotiations were to pave the way for a post-war order based on superpower cooperation. As FDR explained his approach towards Stalin on another occasion, he said, quote, "I think if I give him everything I possibly can and ask for nothing in return, noblesse oblige, he won't try to annex anything and will work with me for a world of democracy and peace," end quote. This hunch, as FDR called it, was at best a naive misreading. Stalin was no gentleman. In fact, at this very summit meeting, Stalin was bugging FDR, who was staying in a suite in the Livadia Palace of the Tsars. Every morning, before the negotiations with the Allied leaders began, Stalin would receive reports on what the American negotiating team had discussed earlier. Did this really give him much advantage in negotiating? That's unclear, but it speaks volumes about Stalin's paranoia and fears. The next summit meeting took place under very different conditions. The gravely ill FDR had died and was succeeded by Harry Truman as president. After the defeat of Hitler, the Big Three leaders now met in the territory of the vanquished Germany, in Potsdam, outside Berlin, in July 1945. Stalin, Truman, and Churchill discussed the still ongoing struggle against Japan. They also discussed details of the shared occupation of Germany. And Truman, at one point in the conversation, also mentioned to Stalin some interesting news. The Americans, he said, had detonated a new weapon of unusual destructive force. Stalin's reaction was kind of strange. He just pretty much shrugged off this news and seemed completely uninterested. In fact, Stalin had long ago known of the atom bomb project from his spies, while Truman had only recently been filled in on the secret details of the program. Over the next 2 years, a chill settled on the earlier alliance, now that the war had been won. In a very real sense, however, what was happening was not so much new tensions as the fact that issues that had been shelved or put aside now really came out into the open. Stalin, for his part, reasserted his personal control in the Soviet Union. In his paranoia, Stalin feared any who had come into any kind of contact with the West during the war. Even Soviet prisoners of war, who were released from prison camps in Germany, were not brought back to a hero's welcome and a victory march in the streets of Moscow. Instead, they were shipped right through onto the Gulag prison camps. They were judged to be traitors who had not fought to the death as they should have. And as a result of coming into contact with the filthy and decadent West, were now potential spies against Stalin. Stalin kept those parts of Poland and the Baltic states that he had won through his deal with Hitler in 1939. And in those other territories of Central and Eastern Europe, where the Red Army was stationed, Stalin also sponsored regimes that were bound to the Soviet Union and administered by his communist followers. In the process, he violated promises that had been made to the hopeful FDR about holding free elections in Eastern Europe after the war. In March 1946, Winston Churchill spoke in a famous speech in Fulton, Missouri, about the Iron Curtain that he said had descended across the heart of Europe, dividing what earlier had been a unified civilization. 1947 would prove a pivotal year, as the Cold War, however much people were reluctant to admit it, became increasingly obvious as a reality. Reacting to a communist insurgency in Greece and Soviet pressure on Turkey, President Truman announced aid to those countries, along with the U.S. Truman Doctrine, which stated that America would support free peoples resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures. Another measure Truman took in this climactic year was to reestablish a worldwide intelligence institution for the United States for the Cold War struggle. Recall that President Truman had shut down the OSS, which had done such work during the Second World War, in September of 1945, after Japan had been defeated, thinking that the need for such an institution was over. Now, 2 years later, Truman was rebuilding what he had disbanded. The National Security Act of September 1947 created the Department of Defense, the National Security Council, and a major intelligence agency without police powers in the United States to keep the American government informed. This was the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. It would be headed by the Director of Central Intelligence, who would also be in charge of all intelligence collection by other agencies. So, in other words, this was to be an overall coordinating figure. The earlier stages of the CIA were necessarily rather improvisational, because questions about its identity and role had to be answered. What was the CIA's mission to be? Was it to be mostly to collect and analyze information? Or was it to engage in covert operations as the OSS had? Could it intervene around the world? Many of the staff of the new agency were former OSS people, and they recalled the war as a formative experience and one that they were very proud of having been shaped by. The document, the NSC Directive 68 in April 1950, which was signed by Truman and only declassified in 1977, finally gave the CIA quite a wide role. It included intelligence gathering, espionage, psychological warfare, covert operations, and paramilitary activity and interventions. The early CIA experienced some embarrassing setbacks in this early improvisational stage. Agents sent into Eastern Europe were frequently betrayed and arrested when they made it behind the Iron Curtain to revolutionize the areas under communist control. After their arrest, many of them were executed. Refugees from Albania, from Ukraine, or the Baltic states who were in the West were recruited by the CIA for these missions and recruited by British intelligence, motivated by patriotism. The opening story of this lecture about the Lithuanian resistance leader Daumantas was part of this larger story. Yet the outcome uniformly was a disaster, costing hundreds of lives. The British intelligence officer and secret Soviet agent Kim Philby was actually key in betraying the existence of these missions to the Soviets, allowing them to round up those who came back. Using a method reminiscent of the fake opposition organization The Trust, which had been set up by the Cheka after the Bolsheviks had first seized power in Russia, Russian intelligence agencies set up a fake resistance movement in Poland in an elaborate construction which fooled the CIA into actually supporting that organization. MI6 also sponsored the return of Baltic refugees as partisans, and they too were usually captured. But the Baltic Forest War, which saw guerrillas facing off against Soviet forces, raged on quite heavily in the 1950s. And as late as 1965, there was an armed engagement in the Lithuanian forests. The very last partisan who had been hiding died in Estonia in 1978. This was a fascinating and tragic corner of the Cold War conflict that today still remains largely unknown to a wider audience. The CIA also failed to give intelligence warning of important events. Even as the Soviets successfully detonated their own atom bomb in 1949, CIA analysts had been predicting that such an event was years off. Before Stalin's comrade in North Korea, Kim Il-sung, invaded South Korea in June 1950, the CIA had not given a warning of such an act. 12 days before communist Chinese forces intervened in the Korean War, a CIA report called this step not probable. It should also be added that there was a parallel intelligence failure on the side of Stalin and his North Korean allies to begin with. They had been convinced the United States would not get involved in a Korean conflict. A claim that is often made by intelligence services is that they're in the position of having their failures known while their successes remain unknown. This is tricky. This can be true, or it potentially can function as an alibi for failures. In the case of the early CIA, successes they were proud of included intervening in the Italian elections of 1948 to forestall communist victory at the ballot box, and generally underwriting the Congress for Cultural Freedom and a number of publications and other organizations that were intended to win intellectuals for Western democratic ideals. The CIA was clearly seen as crucial because it expanded impressively in this early stage. By 1953, it was 6 times larger than it had been back in 1947. A vital and secret American success came with the Venona decrypts. This was a program underway since August of 1943 by the Army Signals Intelligence Service, the precursor to the National Security Agency, with cooperation from the FBI. In terms of tradecraft, this was a good choice of name because Venona appears not to have any meaning behind it. It seems quite a random name to the program, which was to decrypt the wartime telegrams of the Soviet embassy and the consulates in the United States, sending messages back to Moscow. When the war ended, this program concentrated on the large backlog of wartime messages. A breakthrough came in 1946 due to a mistaken tradecraft by Soviet operators who reused one-time pads for encrypting messages. As the name implies, a one-time pad should only be used once. Reusing them allowed patterns to be discerned by cryptologists. Venona remained a secret until the 1990s, although Philby and other Soviet spies told Moscow about it. So they knew, but the general public did not. Soviet messages were not decrypted in real time, but rather years later. Not all the messages were clear. In fact, their use of code names made it difficult to analyze them. But they could be used to pinpoint suspects, as we'll see in a moment. The atmosphere of crisis in the early Cold War, of threat and uncertainty, was heightened by spy hunts in the opposing blocs. Let's consider first the case of the United States, then Stalin's last days in the Soviet Union. In the U.S., there was not only a case of panic, irrationally, because there really had been spies penetrating the U.S. government, and especially the Manhattan Project. First, in the fall of 1945, Elizabeth Bentley, a Vassar graduate and courier for a Soviet spy ring in Washington, defected and told the FBI what she knew. In 1948, the House Un-American Activities Committee called her to their hearings to testify. Also testifying was the former courier, Whitaker Chambers, now an editor at Time magazine. Chambers repeated to the House Un-American Activities Committee what he'd already said back in 1939, that Alger Hiss had been an agent in the 1930s and that he had given Chambers documents from the State Department to give to the Soviets. Alger Hiss was the quintessential establishment figure. He was a graduate of Johns Hopkins and Harvard Law, a member of the New Deal administration, starting at the State Department in 1936. He was with FDR at Yalta and advised on the founding of the United Nations. After the war, Hiss went on to become president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in 1947. Hiss completely denied being an agent and sued Chambers for libel. In response, Chambers produced the so-called pumpkin papers from his farm in Maryland. These were films that he had held back from his courier days to have evidence to protect himself, he said, and he had hidden them improbably in a hollowed-out pumpkin gourd. This is exactly how one imagines espionage takes place. Chambers also produced typewritten papers and handwritten papers that he said were from Hiss. A young California Republican congressman on the House Un-American Activities Committee, Richard Nixon, gained national prominence. He starred in photographs that showed him examining the documents. Now, because the statute of limitations on espionage had expired, Hiss was put on trial for perjury. The first trial ended with a hung jury, but the second one convicted him of lying in 1950 and sentenced him to 5 years in jail. Hiss was released in 1954, and until his death in 1996, Hiss always maintained his innocence. Debate on this case continued heatedly for decades, and indeed into the present day. But Venona materials, released in 1996, brought more evidence to bear. Those decrypts referred to an American agent called Ailes, who had been in the State Department and who was at the Yalta Conference. And the American National Security Agency concluded that this could only be Hiss. For his part, Chambers had not been believed by Truman and the others, and he wrote of his experience and conversion in Witness in 1952, which had that deep pessimism about joining the losing side. All of this was but prelude to another round of spy trials, as the Soviet atomic spies were caught. Klaus Fuchs, who had returned to Britain and was working on nuclear research, had been pinpointed by Venona transcripts. After at first denying the charges, he confessed in January 1950. And he gave leads that were followed up to get comrades of his, including the courier Harry Gold. Harry Gold, in turn, admitted having met with David Greenglass, who in turn was linked to Julius Rosenberg and his wife, who was Greenglass's sister, Ethel. The FBI arrested the Rosenbergs in 1950, and they were indicted by a grand jury. While others in the group confessed, the Rosenbergs claimed innocence. To remain secret, the Venona transcripts were not presented as evidence in trial. Of those charged with atomic espionage, the Rosenbergs were the only ones executed, electrocuted in Sing Sing in 1953, after repeated appeals. Controversy continues to the present day about the sentencing of the Rosenbergs, the appropriateness of the death sentence, especially about the extent of Ethel's role in their activities, how large it had been. While the Soviets were sure to have developed an atomic bomb on their own, given the talents of their physicists, in the fullness of time, later, both Foreign Minister Vyacheslav Molotov and Premier Nikita Khrushchev admitted that the espionage results had saved valuable time and resources. In 1951, the Cambridge spies McLean and Burgess escaped to the Soviet Union. They were warned by their friend Kim Philby that the authorities were closing in on them, again due to Venona decrypts that had pinpointed McLean's identity. The result was that Philby also came under suspicion as a friend of theirs, as a Soviet spy, but he remained free, although he was forced to resign. Meanwhile, in the United States, the fear of subversion took on a dynamic of its own. From 1950, the Republican senator from Wisconsin, Joseph McCarthy, became a famous figure charging that the U.S. government and armed forces were shot through with great numbers of communist agents and spies. Government committees called people to testify. J. Edgar Hoover's FBI investigated those suspected of disloyalty, and the major studios of Hollywood pledged not to employ communists, as did many other businesses. McCarthy's charges got ever wider and wilder, and the numbers of alleged spies fluctuated wildly until in 1954 he was finally censured by the Senate and his stature swiftly collapsed. Ironically, there had been extensive Soviet spying, as we've seen, but in the 1930s and 1940s, after World War II, the Soviets had pulled back from their operations because of the new American wariness. Back in the USSR, just before his death in 1953, Stalin seemed, to the horror even of some of his closest comrades, to be on the verge of organizing a new campaign of internal terror. Did Stalin really believe his own spy scare, or was he using fabrications as a way of reasserting his own control? In March 1946, the NKVD was renamed the MVD, the Ministry of Internal Affairs, Ministerstvo внутренних дел. It was still under Stalin's earlier police chief, Lavrenty Beria. In late 1952, Stalin ordered his secret police to arrest a number of Jewish doctors in Moscow, claiming that they were part of an international conspiracy against the Soviet leadership with orders to poison key government figures and Stalin himself. It seemed that Stalin was taking a page out of Hitler's anti-Semitic playbook. The plot was announced as an American-sponsored outrage in the newspapers on January 1953. But before the purge could get going, Stalin died on March 5, 1953. Ironically, his guards were too frightened to come to his aid quickly after he suffered a stroke. The dynamic of the Cold War would not slow down. It hurtled onwards, with some chillingly dangerous moments for the entire world, poised as it was on the edge of nuclear Armageddon, which we'll trace in our next lecture.